BBC presents My Word. And here to introduce the programme and the panel is Jack Longland.
My Word is a word game played by people whose business is words. And this programme comes to you from the Playhouse in London. Those taking part are Anne Scott-James, Frank Muir, Dillis Powell, and Dennis Norton. Round one tests their vocabularies. 2 marks if they get the meaning of these words roughly right. Beginning with Anne Scott-James. Anne, the meaning of the word effulgent, E-F-F-U-L-G-E-N-T, effulgent.
Oh, a cheerful word. It means shining bright.
Absolutely right. Radiant or brightly shining or sometimes sending out a beam of light, 2 marks. Frank Muir, what is elecampane or elecampane?
Elecampane? It's almost, you know, so simple, it's hardly worth saying. Elecampane, it's like arrivederci, hasta la vista.
Ciao.
It's an old Corsican expression. Alicampagne, which means roughly, instead of mud in your eye, it's here's salamander spawn in your ear.
That's a complicated operation.
Only we think it's a plant.
Uh-huh.
Ah, it's a plant,
you're
Jack.
Right.
Here's a plant in your ear.
It is a plant with yellow flowers and a bitter aromatic leaf and root, used as a tonic drug, or some people, and I can't think why, use it as a sweetmeat when the flavour of the elecampane is put into it. 2 marks. Dillis Powell, the meaning of the word, verb, obtund. O-B-T-U-N-D, obtund.
The verb?
It's a verb. That's helping you.
Oh, that's very kind. Something to do with obtuse.
Yes.
To blunt.
Yes. To blunt or to deaden, and usually it's used medically, to blunt a particular sense or faculty because it's causing you pain or for some other reason.
Oh.
Dennis Norton. Dennis, what is pernoctation? P-E-R-N-O-C-T-A-T-I-O-N. Pernoctation.
Pernoctation. We've got knocked. It's something that happens in the night.
Yes.
Per is through. Something that happens right through the night.
Yes.
Sleeping.
Yes. Yes.
Indigestion after having eaten elecampane, whatever it's called.
2 marks. It means passing the night, but it had a particular sense when the other kind of night with a K in front of him was just about to be made a night. It meant this all-night vigil or passing the whole night in meditation or prayer. Passing the night. 2 marks. Well, before we start round two, I'm going to give each team a quotation for them to write down. And the 2 women members of the team, I hope, will go on studying those quotations, because at the end, I shall ask them where the quotations come from. So, Anne Scott-James and Dennis Norton, your quotation is, we shall shortly see better days. And Dillis Powell and Frank Muir, yours is publish and be damned. And then at the end of the programme, I shall ask Frank and Dennis to give me their ideas of how these came to be said or written. Round two is about legend and mythology. 2 marks for right answers. Beginning again with Anne Scott-James. Anne, what do you know of the Nemean lion? And who killed it? N-E-M-E-A-N. The Nemean lion. And who killed it?
Well, I should think Hercules killed
it.
Yeah. And it was a lion in the region of Nemea.
Which is?
In the Peloponnese.
Yes, quite right. Do you remember how he killed it?
I think he strangled it, didn't he?
Absolutely right. Well done. 2 marks it is. Frank Muir, who alone recognized Odysseus when he returned home after an absence of 20 years, disguised in beggar's rags, and what happened thereafter?
Well, he staggered in and grabbed his wife and said, there's no place like Homer. And then, and what happened afterwards? Well, what ever happens when a husband's been away for 20 years?
Huh? It happened a little before that.
His what?
His dog.
His dog?
Yes. Absolutely right.
His little doggy, you recognize.
Big doggy.
And big doggy.
Big dog, big recognize. Quite right. Yeah. And what happened after?
He licked his hand, and he patted him and tickled his ribs, and the dog's, Argus's back leg. Is that Argus, the name
Argus
of the dog?
The dog, yes. And then you
might more clearly. he tickled Argus, and Argus's back leg went. And
Dennis, what happened to the dog? This is a bit unhard.
I think the dog fell down dead.
He did?
On.
Absolutely right. You get your two marks. You've got everything.
Just ask me a number.
Odysseus, in rags, and 20 years later, was recognized by his faithful dog, Argus, and the dog died of joy, also they say, at that point. 2 marks. Dearest pal, who was Acius, A-C-I-S, who was Acius, whom did he love, and what happened to him as the result of that love?
Acius. Galatea.
Yes?
Galatea. He loved Galatea.
Yes, and what happened to him, poor chap?
Oh, dear. He fell down dead.
Well, not as spontaneous as all that.
He was killed by somebody.
Killed by?
Must have been one of those gods.
Mm. Acis was a very handsome Sicilian shepherd who fell in love with Galatea, the milk-white lady, and she with him. But she was loved by a horrible monster called Polyphemus, the Cyclops. And in his rage, he crushed Acis with a great rock. And then his blood came gushing out, and Galatea kindly changed it into the river Acis, which runs at the foot of Mount Etna. Dennis Norden, who were the Napii? N-A-P-A-E-A-E. Napii.
They had two sets of A-E's on the end.
That's right.
They must have been feminine, then.
Yes, they were.
Napii. It was the Mount Olympus nappy service, actually.
You're not all that far wrong, Dennis.
Well, they were female Latin. They were Roman. They were female in Latin. What they were in Greek.
Well, Greek would be better, yes. The Greek would be better.
Greek, yes. They were Greek females.
Yep.
I think
mortal
that's
or
my
not.
Terminus.
No. Mortal or not?
Oh, immortal.
All right, one out of two. I think this
nymphs,
is a very hard
nymphs,
question.
Were they?
Yes, carry on.
Nymphs on a mount, one of the mountains.
There were various categories of nymphs. And the Napii were the nymphs of the glen, just as the naiads were the nymphs of running water, and dryads were nymphs of the trees, and so on. And then next round, we have a round of Dickens questions. 2 marks again. Anne Scott James, what were the names of David Copperfield's 2 wives, successively?
Oh, the first one was the silly little one, Dora.
Yes?
And the second one was the even more maddening one to me, Agnes.
Do you remember their surnames? Dora. Oh, a bit difficult. Never mind. One and a half.
Agnes de Mille.
Dora Spenlow and Agnes Wickfield. Frank Muir, whom did Pip marry in Great Expectations, and who was her father?
Pip married Emma one afternoon.
Not quite Emma. You got the right start and end. It's not quite Emma.
Her father was the Megwidge, the convict.
Yes, quite right.
She was a stepdaughter, wasn't
yes.
she?
Yes. Pip, in Great Expectations, married Estella, who was the adopted daughter of Miss Havisham, but really the daughter of the ex-convict Abel Megwidge.
Oh, memory.
Dearest Bauer, what were the names of the twin brothers who employed Nicholas Nickleby, and whom did Nicholas marry?
Well, not one of the brothers.
The brothers were the Cherubal brothers.
Quite right.
Cherubal brothers.
And do you remember his...
we married.
The one he married.
Emma.
The employers of Nicholas Nickleby were the Cherubal brothers, Charles and Edwin Cherubal, and he married Miss Madeline Bray. Now, Dennis Norden, can you give me the names of 4 criminal types in Oliver Twist?
Bill Sykes.
Yep.
Fagin.
Yeah.
The Artful Dodger.
Yes, that's 3.
Nancy.
That was yes, that's all right. I would even have allowed Oliver because they made him into a criminal for a bit.
Oh, I never thought of that. Yeah.
2 marks. Next round is about origins and derivations. 3 marks this time. If members of the team can define the, first of all, the present meaning, and then give me the origin and derivation of these words or expressions or phrases. and Scott James, what is a ha-ha and why so called?
Well, it is a kind of a ditch separating a park or garden from the road or the public land outside.
Yes.
It's a shallow ditch.
Purpose being?
To keep the animals out, I think, wasn't it?
Partly. That's half of it.
There's another... the people in.
Ha! That's a splendid idea. Now, there was a visual reason for it as well.
No, to make it look prettier.
Yes, give you a good view.
Mm-hmm. And why so called?
I suppose because people fell in it.
That's it.
Huh? It can't be.
I think 2.5.
Oh, no, look here, Jack. It was so brilliant.
That's near enough. I can't give you quite 3 because you've missed one particular point. It was a sunken trench or moat, preventing animals, as Anne quite rightly said, from getting into the garden of a big house. But the point was that your eye, as you looked out from the French windows, didn't see the interruption caused by the moat. It looked as though the countryside was continuous into the park, although the animals couldn't get at you. And it's said that it was so called because guests every now and then made the ejaculation, ha-ha, when they didn't spot it was there, and as Dennis said, fell foremost into it. Frank Muir, to what does the expression to lead apes in hell refer?
According to John Ray, it was dying a virgin. It was the fate of those ladies who died virgins.
Yeah. At what time? I think you have quoted the...
Well, John Ray was 1670, so yeah. It's presumably 17th century and backwards.
Yeah. Well done. That's your 3 marks. In Elizabethan times, and probably earlier, it was the belief, and you find it in lots of books and plays of the period, that any woman who died a spinster would, after death, be condemned to be a leader of apes in hell. So it was a very uncomplimentary thing to say. And if you look at The Taming of the Shrew, there's one unfortunate girl who's in love with the hero who says, I must dance barefoot on her wedding day and, for your love to her, lead apes in hell. In other words, she didn't get the boy. 3 marks. Dennis Powell, the derivation of the word heathen.
Oh, it means... an unbeliever, a non-religious, an un-Christian person.
And originally?
Well, I think it means something to do with people who live sort of outside cities.
Yes,
In the Mackie.
Yes, in the Mackie, yes.
And why?
Beyond the pale, yes. Kind of thing. Beyond the religious pale.
That's it.
That'll do. That's all right. Today, it means historically, someone who is neither of the Christian nor the Jewish nor the Muslim faith. Also a person nowadays with no accepted religious beliefs at all. But right back in Roman times, they used a similar word, pagan, to refer to people because they lived in the country or on the heath and a long way away from civilized towns, didn't know much about either law or order or gods or religion. So they were looked on as not very much more than animals. And that, in old English and old German, became heath dwellers who became heathens. Or were heathens. Sorry, 3 marks. Dennis Norden, Irish stew.
Oh, it's a shame after being so high-flown.
Yes, simple stuff they keep for you.
Well, it's something you eat. It's a dish of vegetables and potato and lamb.
And what? Best end of neck.
Best end of what?
Neck of lamb.
Best end of neck of...
onions.
But why Irish?
Why Irish indeed? At a wild, imaginative saw of the mind, presumably because it was eaten in Ireland.
Yeah, and it wasn't quite as nice there. This is the point.
No, it wasn't quite as... because they had the potato famine.
You and Anne, between you, are fairly accurate to describe what it is now, so I'll give you 1.5 marks. But this was originally known not only as Irish stew, but as poverty stew, because though over this more prosperous side of the Irish Channel, it was, as Anne says, assorted meats mixed up with certain vegetables. In Ireland, they couldn't afford the meat, and when visitors went to the country, they found the stew was almost entirely potatoes and onions only, and practically no meat at all. And that was called Irish stew. 1.5. And now we come to the last round and go back to those 2 quotations I gave the teams earlier on the program. For 2 marks and Scott James, can you give me the origin of your quotation, which was, "We shall shortly see better days"?
Well, it was said by an optimist.
Well, not entirely.
Well, somebody, I should think it was said by a general who was in straits and was trying to sort of give his men a bit of a push on and a build-up.
No, I don't think you're going to get it.
Not
and I think it's an extremely hard one. It was written by a woman playwright called Aphra Behn in the 17th century in a play called The Roundheads, and it goes like this: "A brave world, sir, full of religion, knavery, and change, we shall shortly see better days." Sorry. And now, Dennis Powell, the origin of your quotation, which was, "Publish and be damned."
Said by the Duke of Wellington. He was threatened by Harriet Wilson with some kind of blackmail. He said, "Publish and be damned."
Yes, you're quite right. The Duke of Wellington, threatened by some scandalous memoirs. It's attributed to the Duke of Wellington. Whether he actually said it or not, one doesn't know. 2 marks. And now I'm going to ask Dennis and Frank to give me their explanations of how these quotations came into being. And on this occasion, the marks will go to whichever incredible explanation receives the longer applause from the audience here in the theatre. So back to Dennis Norden with his quotation, "We shall shortly see better days."
I very much want your help with this. It's a game. It's a new game, which I'd be awfully glad if you'd sort of spread and make it into a craze. It's a game called "Who's the Welshman?" It's very easy. You say it back. "Who's the Welshman who plays a stringed instrument?" And somebody says, "I don't know." You say, "Dilute." You see, "Who's the Welshman who never wears a shirt?" "Divest." You see, it's very easy to get the hang of. "Who's the Welshman who drives a lorry?" "Divan." I'm foisting this upon you is because it's rather urgent. It's rather desperate as far as I'm concerned. It started last night. I was obliged to stay late in the office. Well, when I say I was obliged to stay late, I didn't mean to stay late. But I've got one of these pencil sharpeners screwed to my desk, you know, the sort with a little handle, which has a little dial in front of it, which has different sized holes for the various diameters of pencil. About 5:30, I don't know why the thought occurred to me, but it did, to see which of these holes my finger would fit into. By about 10:30, the building was deserted, and I was thinking seriously about amputating when the phone rang. And I picked it up with the other hand, and a voice said, "I shall be there in 2 minutes, man. You will recognize me because I shall have a leak in my hat." And rang off. I thought it was a rather odd message to receive when you've got your finger in a pencil sharpener. In his hat, I thought, you know. It's a funny place to have a leak. But sure enough, about 5 minutes later, the door opened and in came this little man who did have this strange sort of vegetable in his trilby. And he said to me, "Are you the Welsh one?" And I said, "What Welsh one?" He said, "One of you is a Welsh one." So I said, "Well, I'm not a Welsh one. And I'm sure Frank isn't. He may be an English one, but..." He said, "One of you is Welsh." He said, "We heard it from the wireless. Muir and Morgan." No, I said, "Muir and Norden." "Damn," he said. "Intelligence got it wrong again. How can you run a revolution when your intelligence service gets it wrong every time?" I said, "What revolution are you running?" He said, "Welsh Nationalist Party we are. We shall overcome." I said, "You really belong to the Welsh Nationalist Party?" He said, "Yes." He said, "It is jokes we want." I said, "I'm afraid I... He said, "You realize that the Welsh are the only minority that doesn't have rotten jokes about them."
It says Jewish jokes, Scottish jokes, elephant jokes. Surely a Welshman is more valuable than an elephant? I said, well, not if you're another elephant. He didn't think it was very funny either. He took out this knife and he said, you will write jokes about Welshmen and flood the country with them, you will. And if you don't, the penalty will be swift and painful. Well, as I say, this was last night, when you can't get very far with your finger stuck in pencil sharpener. And as I say, the best I could do in the short time available was this game of who's the Welshman, you know. Who's the Welshman whose clock is always slow? Die late. Who's the Welshman who runs the church? Director. I know they're terribly primitive, which is why I want your help. And if you do, I can assure any Welsh nationalists who are listening that we shall see better dies.
I like Newer and Morgan so much better, I intend to use that form of address exclusively in future. So, Newer, publish and be damned.
I do think it's a bit sickening. I'm speaking as a scholar and a historian now, with a man of John Longland's erudition here doesn't know whether, in fact, the Duke of Wellington said this or not. He said it's attributed to the Duke of Wellington. I think there's a great shame on a splendid chap. A chap who did a lot for England. And I've been doing researches into the Duke of Wellington's history, and I found some rather surprising things about him. That expression, up guards an atom, attributed to the Duke of Wellington, Waterloo. In fact, he didn't say it at Waterloo at all. He said it at the Duchess of Richmond's ball on the eve of Waterloo when the ladies entered. During the Battle of Waterloo, something rather odd occurred to the Duke. He found out that his adjutant was a woman. His adjutant was Lieutenant Harry Twilson, apparently. But one night, when they were dancing, and he noticed his adjutant was dancing backwards. So he thought, that's odd. That's the way a woman dances. So he confronted his adjutant, and by golly, it wasn't Harry Twilson at all. She confessed that her name was actually Harriet Wilson. She was a chorus girl in a musical show called Goodbye, Dolly, I Must Leave You. And her lover had been taken for a soldier. He'd accepted George III's shilling and joined up with the Duke's forces. And she'd disguised herself as a man, enlisted, and was now the Duke's adjutant. Well, so there she was, a girl in the Duke's army. She'd been there for about 6 months. Nobody had given her away. Why would they give her away? And the Duke took her into his tent. He thought, he's a very kind man, he thought that the rough soldier's tongue wouldn't fit her ladylike ear. And he invited her into his tent, and just invented by Mr. Bell, and thereby docking the clangor of his life. He was, as they say in the papers, constant companions with Harriet Wilson all during the campaign. Well, the campaign finished. He was made, as you know, the Duke of Wellington. He became Prime Minister. And standing outside his home, number 1 Piccadilly, Apsley House, given to him by the nation, actually by the Westminster City Council, it was the first council house ever. Suddenly a figure came up to him, a figure he half recognised, a dumpy, rather middle-aged, slightly rattled lady. And she said, do you remember me, Arthur? Do you remember me? I'm Harriet Wilson. He said, oh, yes, madam. And she said, I'm writing my memoirs. And I'm going to tell all about you and me. Everybody knows I was your friend. I'm going to reveal to the world every Sunday exactly the sort of woman I am. He stared at her, this aloof, rather grand, old, very old English gentleman. And she said, pay me 200 guineas in gold and I will suppress my memories. And he looked at this old thing with a fat tummy and the mauve purplish grog blossom on her cheeks. And that's when he said the famous line, we can see the sort of woman you are, madam. Purplish and betummed.
I wanted to know where John Masefield got that wonderful man-woman character in The Midnight Folk, Twiny Pricker or Tiny Twicker or whatever it was. And by your vote, Dennis Norden just wins the contest of the two stories, and that leads us, nevertheless, to a final score in which Phyllis Powell and Frank Muir win by 5 marks, and it also brings to an end this edition of My Word.
In My Word, you heard Dillis Powell, Anne Scott James, Frank Muir, and Dennis Norden, introduced by Jack Longland. The program was devised by Tony Shryan and Edward J. Mason, and presented by the BBC. ¶¶